Our first speaker, ladies and gentlemen. Our author has a tale to tell of just one shop that began to sell its books, and he remembers well how that one shop grew higher and higher till it became a unique business empire that we all know. It's in our bones. We were always aware of Waterstones. The Face Pressed Against the Window is his title. So was ours. He was not alone. I'm delighted to welcome Tim Waterstone.
Thank you so much. It's very, really lovely to be here. And it's very lovely to be here. And it's July the 2nd is the date. And July the 2nd is a very precious date for me because it was on July the 2nd, and I celebrate every year with a glass of champagne for this, on July the 2nd, 1981, that I was fired by W.H. Smith. And it was the most glorious, glorious moment because I knew exactly what I was going to do. I was going to go to what I wanted to do for so long, which was to do Waterstones. I've been writing the business plan for years to do it. And I would have done it earlier, but the problem is I kept on getting married. kept on having children, and somehow life had turned out to be a monthly struggle to pay the mortgage and keep the school fees going and everything else. I kept on putting it off. But the moment that I was fired, I knew I was going to do it. And the problem is that in order to get my first branch up and running, I had to have well over £100,000 on the table, and I only had £6,000 in 1981 in my bank account. So the fear was, how was I going to raise this extra money? Because it was an enormously ambitious business plan. It said that within 10 years we were going to be the biggest bookselling group in Europe and the most profitable business group, bookselling group in Europe. But I only had £6,000 to start it off. So where was this money going to come from? So somebody said to me, there's a very good bank manager, Cranley, in Surrey, who is a young man. He's very ambitious, and he has a very good record of supporting new businesses. So I got hold of the manager, Barclays Bank in Cranley, and I got hold of Barclays Bank, and he allowed me to go down to present to him, and I presented him my business plan. We were going to become the biggest bookselling group in Europe in 10 years, and all he had to do was just add to my £6,000 with about £150,000, and we'd be on our way. And he said, do you have another 15 copies of this plan? It's very interesting. So I said, no. But I'll go and photocopy them. So I ran off down Cranmere High Street, and I found a photocopy shop, and I printed off 15 copies, and I went back to the bank, and I gave them to him, and he said, well, that's very good. We'll be in touch. Well, ladies and gentlemen, he never was in touch, but I heard later what he'd done with my lovely business plan was that very afternoon, Barclays Bank were running a seminar in Surrey for young managers, and he'd used my gorgeous business plan as an example of the sort of business you shouldn't lend money to under any circumstances whatsoever. So back to square one. And by this time, I'd found a site to open our new first branch in, which is in South Kensington and Old Brompton Road. So I was desperate to get this money together. And I knew once we had the first tranche of money together, I'd be able to raise more and more and more and more. So a friend of mine said, well, I tell you somebody, another guy who's good, he's quite an elderly manager, he's a senior manager, he runs the Nat West branch in Covent Garden. So why don't you go and talk to him? So again, I made the appointment, I went and presented my lovely business plan again, and even more passion than I'd done in Cranley. And he listened and listened and stared at me, and then I finished the presentation, and there was an absolute dead silence. And he looked at me, and he said, Mr. Waterwell, he said, I thought it was a good start, Mr. Waterwell, I cannot make out whether you're a genius or a madman, but I'm retiring on Tuesday, you can have the money. So we were on our way, and we opened that branch in South Kensington. What was this business plan we had? Well, as I said, it was enormously ambitious, but foretold we were going to open branch after branch after branch after branch at such a speed that we would dominate the country here over that period. But I think you have to, you're all too young, but if you can reflect back to 1981, the standard of bookselling in Britain then really was extraordinarily weak. There was W.H. Smith, who had 35% of the market. 35% of the market was in the hands of W.H. Smith with their high street offer. And which was a very popular offer, so there's no literary element to it whatsoever. There were the university bookshops, which were very good. There was Blackwell's in Oxford, there was Heffer's in Cambridge, there was Dillon's up the road from here, there was James Thynne in Edinburgh, John Smith in Glasgow, perhaps. So they were doing fine. But there were so few independents who were doing anything with the market at all. So few. Very, very few indeed. In London, there was Haywood Hill, there was Compendium, there was Hatchard's, and there was the lovely John Sandow in Chelsea. Outside London, there were some quite well-known bookselling names around the country, but they were doing a derisory job. Underqualified staff, ignorant staff, one has to say, very thin stock, very short trading hours, no sense of marketing at all going on. Wherever you went, Gloucester, Worcester, Birmingham, Newcastle, all these places we did go to, Newcastle, Manchester, Leeds, wherever you went, it was the same thing. So we attacked the country as fast as we could. And the offer was incredibly simple. It was just to have a tiny head office, tiny, tiny head office, and all the power and all the investment going out into the branches where we employed only young staff broadly. They were straight down from university mostly. They had arts degrees, and they were bursting with enthusiasm and knowledge, and they got the branches, and they had control of their branches, and they all competed with each other all the time. They were young, and it was a great risk to give people, in a way, that degree of responsibility, but I wanted to keep the head office element of the business extremely small and extremely cheap. Our first head office was about 12 foot by 12 foot. It was so small, and there was a lavatory that came off it. And they only had two chairs, and we had three staff. We had me and two accountants. That was all it was. So if all three of us were in the office at the same time, two got the chairs, the other one had to sit on the loo at the other side. They were so young, these people coming in, working with us. And it wasn't my business plan any longer. Everybody in the company knew what we were trying to do, and we're very proud of it. And the roots of it in my history, I know where they came from. I was brought up in what was then a village called Crowborough in Sussex, which is now you know, like Croydon, but it's only 2,000 or 3,000, very most, more like 2,000 people lived there. And yet there was in the village an absolutely superb independent bookshop, which opened up just after the war when I was six. And the moment I discovered it, I remember the day before it opened, peering through the window, and there it was. And I spent practically my whole childhood there. I just loved being in the bookshop. It was just Miss Santoro who owned it, and an assistant, and they were brilliant. They were absolutely brilliant booksellers. They knew every book they had, enormous enthusiasm, marketing drive, and Miss Santoro really took me under her wing, and she basically taught me to read. I was a very slow reader at six and seven, and she taught me to read, and then she told me what to read. And I never bought a book there throughout my childhood, because I had no money. But she welcomed me to the shop all the time, and there's a bench in the shop where she used to let me sit. She used to pretend it was Tim's bench, you know, as if only me allowed to use it. And I used to deliver books for her around the village on my bike. And that went all the way through till I was 18 and 19. I went to Cambridge, and there, of course, was Heffer's. And the moment I walked into Heffer's, I knew what the perfect combination would be a combination of wonderful Heffer's with the tiny, really, but brilliant Miss Santoro style of bookselling. And that's what Waterstones became. And more and more investors came in. Max Hastings was then editor of the Evening Standard, wrote the most fantastically positive piece about us in the Evening Standard a few months after we opened, and that brought in a whole wave of shareholders came in, including Laurence Olivier, who came in at that point, and away we went. And the bigger and bigger, the goal of being the biggest booksellers in Europe became closer and closer. After 4 years, we had 20 branches spread throughout the country. After 6 years, we had 49. And by the time we got to the 10-year mark, we had 100. And we were, by that point, the biggest in the country. And incidentally, when we got to that point, there was a lovely piece for us about us in the Times. And I sent that down. I traced the Cranley bank manager, the man who'd used my business plan, around the country in my vindictive way. And I then found he was the bank manager in Hove. And I sent him down the press cuttings and down to him saying, "Do you remember me?" modestly as always. And he sent them straight back saying, "Win some, lose some." Well, the publishers all loved us because we were the only people opening bookshops, and the authors all loved it. So the 80s and the 90s, particularly the early 80s, were a phenomenal time of new writers coming through. Salman Rushdie just won the Booker Prize, Peter Ackroyd, William Boyd. Oh, so many, Ishiguro, A.S. Byatt, Jeanette Winterson, a whole wave of people coming through. Anthony Beaven, I come to you here on my left as well, coming through at that time. And of course, for them, we were the only people really who were, those days, literary festivals didn't exist. I mean, Hay existed and Cheltenham existed, but there were none of those lovely local festivals now held. But of course, Waterstones, as we went around the country, we were the festivals. So we did an enormous amount of author promotion, as much as we could possibly do in each branch, organized by the branches themselves, and they're all competing with each other to see who could get the best authors in that run the best evenings. Well, there we were. We got to the 10-year mark, and on the whole, we got lots of nice things said about us, but just occasionally we had something very unpleasant. Oh, booksellers, of course, hated us, absolutely loathed us. And one or two journalists came in on the back of that, and then one particular journalist, I recall, and this is where I'll close this little speech, wrote a piece about me in the Evening Standard in 1992, so we were just 10 years old at that point. And the moment I saw the byline and recognized the journalist's name, I knew we were in trouble because she specialized. I'm not going to give her name now, but she's a very familiar name to you. She specialized in put-downs, you know. And she started off with a description of my personal experience, personal appearance, which was, shall we say, frank, to say, point of bald, small, unimpressive sort of stuff about me, what I look like. But she ended up with the most magnificent insult I have ever read or heard. I love it. In fact, we have it in our downstairs loo in our family house. And it's this, I can repeat it to you verbatim. She wrote, "Mr. Waterstone is by repute about as interesting to talk to as a lock keeper on a disused canal." It's very good. I didn't mind the personal appearance stuff at all. But I should just say in closing, I did know that lady journalist very slightly, but I still do. And, well, I have to report, ladies and gentlemen, that she herself is no oil painting.